From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Close your eyes for just a moment and imagine holding your loved one's hand. You feel the warmth of their hand in yours, and in this case, you also feel sweat and a tremor of fear, because you're packed into a cattle car along with hundreds of other people, human beings each holding a loved one's hand, holding and squeezing and desperately hanging on, because you know as soon as the train stops, the doors open, and a harsh light cuts through the darkness, that at that moment, you may be separated. You may never hold your loved one's hand again, because your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your child may be sorted and murdered by the Nazi killing machine. Well, that is what happened at the Auschwitz death camp until this day, 75 years ago, when Soviet soldiers liberated Auschwitz. Anna Ornstein knows what it's like to try to hold on to her loved ones. She knows what it's like when that last grip is broken. Anna is a survivor of Auschwitz, and she's here with us today.
Yes.
Thank you for being with us today, Anna.
It is my very great pleasure to be here.
Whose hand were you holding?
Yeah, I was holding my mother's hand, but desperately trying to hold on to my father's hand as well. And that was not possible. My father was taking care of his mother, who was 92 at the time. And so he had to watch for her because there was a crowd of people behind us and all around us and screaming and yelling and barking. It is very difficult to describe what it is like. What I can try if anybody wants to hear the details, but whose hand was I here if I holding? My mother held on to my hand. She was very much aware that it is impossible for me to hold on to both my mom and dad.
And you were all in that cattle car.
We were about, as you said earlier, about 100 people, and there was a lot of noise. There were people who came into the wagon and started to say very in Yiddish, which I did not fully understand, but the message was, give the babies to the older people. My mother somehow got the idea here that maybe babies and older people will be selected, that they will be dying here, and that maybe the people who came into the wagon tried very hard to get the young women holding the babies to be that they would be able to survive. But can you imagine that a mother would give away her baby under these circumstances? They weren't aware of what is going on. So maybe it will be helpful for me to say the time of the year that we arrived in Auschwitz, because it will give you an idea what it was like when the doors opened and these people came into the wagon and trying to give this message. Actually, this is June. June, the first part of June, I don't know the day, but now I know that it happened to be the time that the American troops were landing in Normandy, that we were hoping for that, but we were not aware of the fact that the American troops were there. And so, you know, here is the hope, but at the same time, the total inability to imagine what is ahead of us.
So June 1944 then.
This is June 1940 some.
And when the doors opened.
Yes.
On the train car. I mean, it had pulled into Auschwitz from Hungary?
Yes. It came directly from Hungary.
Because you're Hungarian.
I'm Hungarian.
What happened after the doors opened and you heard those people speaking in Yiddish and you were holding on to your mother's hand?
Yes.
How long were you able to hold on to her hand? How long were you able to hold?
Luckily, because she held my hand very firmly. In a way, you would have to imagine that we were very conscious to hold hands for the rest of the year that we were in the camps.
Of course, you would never want to let them go, right?
No. I don't know whether time will permit me to tell you certain instances when it was not possible for us to hold on to each other, and that I managed to hold on to her one way or another.
Well, what about that first time when you were taken off the car? Because that is when that selection process happened.
Correct.
So what happened to you and your family then, in that immediate first moment?
Yeah. Now, first you had to get out of the car, and you are being pushed and shoved. When we are here in this studio, you don't hear the dogs barking, the Germans screaming, schnell. We always had to hurry. You don't know why you had to hurry. So if you're asking me what happens first as we are getting out, I was not fully aware of the process of selection. That very moment I cannot visualize right now. Mm. We came back to Auschwitz at a later date. Maybe I can tell you about that. I was much more conscious of the selection process and the presence of a particular man called Mengele, who was in charge of that. But this first time around, I just relied on my mother holding my hand and wherever we were taken. And the next thing I can just remember more clearly was that we were pushed and shoved into an area where we were organized into a column, you know, a lot of. This was, by the way, the German way of organizing the people. Immediately, they say you have to stand by five so that they could count.
Uh-huh.
They can look through the lines and see the people. By then, I was definitely separated from my father and my grandmother and my uncle and my extended family.
Did you ever see them again?
No. Those people, no. No. I had no idea. Yes. Now we know, you know, and I know. But I had no idea that people actually being killed there, no. My mother, again, I have to bring her into the story because she smelled, we all smelled, but we didn't know what we are smelling, very heavy smoke. This is a middle of the day in June, and there is no sun because there is so much smoke. And only after we exited, when we were already on the ground, I heard my mother telling the wife of a cousin that she thought this smell smelled like burning flesh, human flesh. I overheard that. I got scared, and my mother, like a mother would, turned to me and said, "No, this is just a rumor," trying to keep me innocent. And she managed to do that because would anybody even consider that human flesh is burning. But she was right, that it was true.
So much so that it blotted out the sun?
That it burnt, it was just pretty thick, a lot of smoke. You have to consider, this is a small Hungarian Jewish population. We were less than a million people mm-hmm. in the country. And they managed to put us together, managed to get everybody in line in such a way that in 5, maybe 6 weeks, more than the half of the Jewish population of Hungary was, I will put it very simply, they were up in smoke. They were killed. Now, I sound so. Yes, that's what happened. My father, my grandmother, uncle, my little cousins, yes.
I don't even know what to say right now, and to be perfectly honest, but we have to take a quick break. Maybe this is a good time for a break.
That's fine.
I just want to make a note that you were 17.
Yes.
The first time you were taken to Auschwitz.
Yes.
We'll talk more about your experiences and also how you see the world today, 75 years later, if we have, as the human race, if we have learned the lessons.
Yes, if we had.
If we have. So we're listening to Anna Ornstein. She is a survivor of Auschwitz. The Nazi death camp was liberated 75 years ago today. Later on, we're going to want to hear your stories, too. How are you remembering this day? How is your family remembering this day? And do you think we as humanity have taken aboard the lessons of never forget? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're marking the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration and death camp. It was liberated by Soviet soldiers 75 years ago today. And we're also asking the bigger question, 75 years later, have we all, as human beings, learned the lessons of the Holocaust? Do we know what it really means to never forget? And if not, what will it take to get us there? So we want to hear from you, your stories, your family's stories, your feelings about this moment as a citizen of this nation. I'm joined today by Anna Ornstein. She was 17 years old when she was first taken to Auschwitz in 1944. And she's telling us her story today. And Anna, before we go any farther, I would like to tell you also that we should note that your life following this horrific experience is a celebration of accomplishment, and not just survival, but thriving. Right? You went on to become a doctor, a very deeply respected name in psychiatry. Obviously, you came to the United States, became a mother yourself, an author. So there's a celebration to be had here in your life. And I wanted to just note that as well.
Thank you.
And also today's your birthday.
Oh, no.
So happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Let's continue to celebrate your life. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
All that said, you're giving us the gift of telling us your story. So could you tell us more about what happened to you and your mother in those first days and weeks after you were first taken to Auschwitz?
Okay. This will be very brief because my memory is okay, but so much happened afterwards that some of it is no longer quite as clear. I can tell you that at that point, the first place we were taken to were some barn-like places where they take off all our, earlier already they took our little baggages. We didn't have much, but everything, clothes, hair, body hair, whatever. So people could barely recognize each other. And then we were put into a place that was not an ordinary barrack. There were no places to sleep. We just sat on the floor and leaned on each other's backs. We took turns to try a little bit of a rest by learning how to do that. We stayed in that place for several days. The only reason I remember what they gave us to eat because it made us to go to the latrine a lot. And so this was maybe 4 days, five, six, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Retrospectively, I would say about a week that we spent in that situation without sleep, without rest. And then we were picked up and taken back to the railway station and taken to a camp that, interestingly, many people who are listening to this program, a camp that became very famous by a movie, Schindler's List. So we were taken to Plaszów, was the name of the camp, near Krakow. And it was a horrendous place because our work was such that within the 2 months that we spent there, my mother lost a lot of weight. I did probably too, but at her age, it meant more than maybe it had affected me. But there I saw a lot of horrendous images of people being beaten. Yes, that was a place. Well, what made us happy, quote unquote, if you see the image, that we were told that we are very lucky because they just stopped killing every 10th person in the morning at the Seel, it's called, I can only say it in German, Seelappell. This is when you stand in line, sometimes for an hour, to be counted. And that, they were, apparently, they stopped doing that particular way of getting rid of people. What happened there then, that the German, and you know that, and the people will be aware of the importance of what is happening during the war at this time. That this was after Stalingrad, so that the Germans really were put on the run.
Right.
Okay. So they are now getting closer to the areas where we were in Krakow, in Poland. And when that happened at the end of the summer, we were put back into the cattle wagons. A very scary thing. And we had a good reason to be concerned because we were taken back to Auschwitz.
Yeah. And that was September, I believe.
Yeah.
End of the summer,
and this,
you said?
I cannot tell you for sure. We had no idea about day and yeah. once, and because you lose contact of that.
And can I ask you, on this being taken back to Auschwitz, that yes. that time, I read in other interviews that you've done that was that second time was when you got the tattoo?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a tattoo. I still have that tattoo on my
The number.
Yeah, the number. That was also done twice. You know, all in all of this, the Germans were very methodical and they kept doing what they thought needed to be done.
Well, so this is part of why we must never forget, because, I mean, methodical is the right word. Industrial is the scale of what the slaughter was. And it was institutionalized. It was enacted by a state. And that is one of the lessons here of the experience that you and your family had to endure, the horror that you had to endure.
Yes.
As I read your story, my heart stopped multiple times because it is unimaginable, I have to say, but yet it's real. It's sort of one of those things that your brain both can't process and must accept that it happened.
Exactly.
You and your mother, the second time you were brought to Auschwitz,
yes.
was it in that time that you actually were taken towards the gas chamber?
Yes, you know, thank you reminding me, because I've forgotten about it for a long time. I forgot about that night that we were taken. I had a cousin, rather married to a cousin, who was an artist. And I went to her studio, and I saw these pictures with special flowers. I don't know what they are called in English. And I said, Wally, these flowers, where did I see them? Why do they look so familiar to me? She says, don't you remember? And that helped me remember that night. That we were taken, yes, to the gas chamber. And then, because the Germans still hoped, maybe, that with our help, and I have to laugh at that, consider that they thought that we Hungarian Jewish women, the way we looked, would be still be useful to them. And that is why our lives were spared. I really don't know what other explanation, but suddenly we were told that we will go back to our cabins. Now, there was a moment.
I'm so sorry to interrupt here, but I just want to understand. So a group of you were taken to
We did not realize that.
Okay.
We did not know that. I don't know if my mother would have known that. I only know that it was a very long night, and we were not supposed to lay down. I mean, we were standing up all this time, and I suspect my mother kind of lost her. She did not know what was happening, because at one point she said, little girl, please, you have to move. My daughter is coming.
She was telling you that. She was
telling me that.
I see.
So I think my mother may not have been aware either, because after all this, you may have to think about the way your brain, your mind, mm-hmm. stops functioning properly either. I don't know what happened to her, but she did not recognize me, mm-hmm. What happened. The next thing I remembered eventually, and I remember it even now, we were herded into a structure, and I was pushed against the wall there. I know that for sure, because as I was pushed, I felt a great deal of pain mm-hmm. in my back. And now that here in our studio, you have to imagine that you are in the middle of a huge mass of people, and they are pushing you because they are being pushed at the door or where.
So you're being crushed almost.
And I was, and I was against that wall, and that wall was not a mason. It was not finished. And that kind of woke me up. If you think pain sometimes can be very helpful, because it kind of opened my mind. I remember that moment very clearly, that I was pushed against that wall. Naturally, still don't knowing why we were in that building or for what purpose. And as I mentioned earlier, I found out after years we were at that point, at that near the gas chambers. But I did not know until I saw those flowers in the painting that reminded me of that. So that was Auschwitz. I don't know if you want me to tell the story more or you have some questions.
I have many questions, Anna. But if this is actually a good time for us to bring in another voice into the conversation,
By all means.
We could. So joining us now from Bloomington, Indiana, is Alvin Rosenfeld. Alvin is a professor of English and Jewish Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's also director of the university's Institute for the Study of Contemporary Antisemitism. Professor Rosenfeld, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on your program.
So we've been hearing Anna's story and her experiences. You know, there isn't just one story, obviously, of what happened in Auschwitz or one survivor story. But what do you hear, Professor Rosenfeld, as Anna recounts what happened?
Yes,
to her?
It's a hair-raising story. She's had a remarkable experience, and she must be immensely strong to have survived all of that and gone on to recreate her life in the way you described. The Hungarian Jews were the last Jews to be transported to Auschwitz. And among those people destroyed there, there were more Hungarian Jews murdered than Jews from any other country. So her story is very representative in that respect. What I would stress most of all is that Auschwitz really does mark the end of one era and the beginning of another era. We're not talking about warfare in the common sense, but about something that just never happened before. And thinking that through and living in the aftermath of all of that is a very, very serious responsibility for all of us, especially at a time when hatreds of many different kinds have been let loose in a rather unrestrained way, including, once again, hatred against Jews.
This is a fear that I have, that perhaps in the Jewish community there will be a dedication to remembering, to never forgetting, to learning from the experiences. But as people like Anna, as we get further and further away from it, for the rest of humanity, when we start losing those personal connections to what happened 75 years ago, I mean, Professor Rosenfeld, are we forgetting? Are we at risk of that?
Yes and no. Lots of people remember and lots of people know. But if you look at the results of some recent polls taken regarding what Americans know and don't know about the Holocaust, the results are pretty shocking, I have to say. Something like 40% of Americans evidently have no idea about Auschwitz, and 65% of millennials don't even recognize the name. We have a great deal of information about the Holocaust. It's the most copiously documented crime in history, so we don't lack for sources. At the same time, a large number of people are just ignorant of what happened, and that's not a good situation whatsoever. We have our work cut out for us, that's for sure.
Well, Professor Alvin Rosenfeld and Dr. Anna Ornstein, stand by here for just a moment. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back as we mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're marking the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz today, and we're joined by Dr. Anna Ornstein. She was 17 years old when she was first taken to Auschwitz in 1944. And Alvin Rosenfeld also joins us. He's a professor of English and Jewish studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. And let's go to a couple of calls here. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to comment on what a just such a painful and crushing story that you told, Ms. Ornstein, but again, sort of the uplifting ending, the fact that you're here and you're able to tell it. Myself and my family, if I could briefly just talk a little bit about it. My wife and myself, my wife's family, her father was the only survivor of seven brothers and sisters. He was from Poland, from Lutz. My father lost a wife and a daughter. He was Austrian, from a little town called Deutschkreuz on the border, right on the border of Hungary and Austria. Maybe you know it. I think it was called Groz, or Zellum was the Yiddish word for the town. And Jews had lived there for hundreds of years. After Kristallnacht, the Germans rounded up about 30,000 men. I believe my father was taken to either Buchenwald or Dachau. I'm not sure which one. And there were two Jewish brothers in England who had established a youth camp, actually a camp. A lot of the kinder transport kids went there. But there were 4,000 Jewish men that they also bargained for with the Germans that were taken from these camps and able to go to England, where my father went. He was 33, and this was 1938. Couldn't take his wife, couldn't take his daughter. He could only go. Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed. The rules were you couldn't reside in the UK. You had to move on. Couldn't work. There were these 4,000 men in this camp in Kent, I believe it was where the camp was. They were allowed to encouraged to join the British Army, which he did.
Right.
There were 886 men of these 4,000. He joined the Pioneer Corps, which was an English Jewish battalion or corps of men who went back to fight on the continent. And that's where he met my mother. He found out his wife and his 10-year-old daughter had been sent to a camp in Opetal, where they died of typhus.
Uh-huh.
He met my mother in England, where they married, and after the war. And we lived there for 18 years, and then we immigrated to the U.S. with my sister and myself in 1956. And He died in 1961, but it was something that he never talked about. So my sister and I grew up not knowing really much, just living with this reality that we're here because others died. But yet we're here, and we had children, and our children have had children, and it's, again, painful and crushing, but it's like, in a way, the phoenix rising. That's...
Well, Michael, if I may, thank you so much for that call, because when you said, Michael, that your father never talked about it, Anna, Dr. Orenstein nodded her head with a sense of knowing. So, I mean, that is common, not wanting to
talk
about it.
Yes, very. Yeah. It's very painful. And many people felt that they want to protect their children from these horrors. It was parental love. But at the end, it was unfortunate in some way, because I feel very strongly by telling the story, we are educating young people what the human mind is capable of in terms of hate, and where hate can take you. You know, I know in many schools they teach children about bullying, and it is certainly one way of telling this is something you should learn about, but it would not hurt if more places would say, look, when you do this with your friends, you are not thinking that this kind of treating people in that way can accelerate it. It could become worse with time when just little things, by the time you are able to hold a weapon, a gun, you can end up behaving in ways that you did not intend. But here you are now. Maybe you are in a member of an organization that believes in hating the Jews, the Muslims, or who. All these happens very quickly. People become indoctrinated.
Yes.
And the mind, unfortunately, and this is why we need to teach the Holocaust. Look, if it was a human, these were humans who did these crimes. This was not in another world. We used to say, when you say Auschwitz was another world, no.
No, yeah.
These were people who could think in these terms.
So Professor Rosenfeld, what Dr. Orenstein says just makes me think that we talk about never forgetting. We also talk about never again.
Yes.
And yet it has happened.
Exactly.
Right? The Bosnian genocide, Rwanda.
Absolutely.
The Rohingya, the current treatment of Uyghurs in Western China. I mean, Professor Rosenfeld, it seems as if humanity has not released itself from its passion for institutionalized murder.
We're living at a time of mass violence, and you just ticked off some major examples of that. That's the case. The Holocaust is not the best word for this crime, but we're stuck with it for now, is almost beyond hate. It involved a kind of institutionalized cruelty and genocidal passion that we hadn't had before. At least not along those lines. The Nazi system was vast. The researchers at the U.S. Holocaust Museum in D.C. now count something like 40,000 incarceration sites that the Nazis ran. That includes jails, prisons, brothels, transit camps, labor camps, death camps, you name it. If you're going to have something like 40,000 institutions of this sort, including ghettos, you're going to need a vast army of people to man those places, run those places, and carry out the kind of evil deeds that took place day after day. Dr. Orenstein is a witness to all of that. There are others as well. Sometimes we just need a new vocabulary to find our way into that in order to grasp it as best we can, it'd be comforting to think that it's all over and done with, that it is a thing of the past. It's simply not the case.
Anna, can I ask you, you're absolutely right that things begin and they seem more manageable, bullying, like you said, but if allowed to accelerate, it becomes indoctrination, as you were talking about.
Yes.
I'm curious. We definitely are seeing anti-Semitism on the rise in the United States. But are you also seeing, are you concerned that there are other, potentially other examples of how institutions or governments become vehicles to spread hatred?
Yes, unfortunately.
Tell me more. Where? Do you see that in the United States?
Thank you for saying it for me, because I wasn't sure whether I would be permitted to say. We are right here. We witness. When people are told, go back where you came from. These were young women, who were three of the four whom our president said, go back from. You remember the incident? What do you make of that? That people born in this country are told something like that. We are a nation of immigrants. Now we are not supposed to open our doors to the very people we need for our own survival. I cannot get over the fear that is being created in all of us when we listen to this kind of language and this kind of behavior. I am very committed to talk to as many young people as I possibly can. I started to talk after we came to this country, and over the years, it became more and more important in my mind that we don't know what the children hear at home, but there should be some place in their lives when they know what is going on in the world. And it's interesting. I find I am going to schools quite often. Now I just began to go to schools again, because this is where we have an opportunity to educate young people. And the Holocaust is just one way to say you have to consider that what is today just a simple, like my, I will have to say that a little bit, it takes me another moment to tell you how, why I think the way I do. I have a friend who was born in Berlin, and she was 9 years old when she was in Holland. And we frequently talk about these things. And she would say to me, you remember when there were the benches in the park that said, Nicht für Juden. Jews were not to sit on these benches. Had we at that time consider to bring a Gentile friend and sit on that bench and wait for the police, and they would have come. And I think that our children may have to be taught and prepared for the possibility that they have to understand and resist the kind of befehl, the kind of the, people are told to do this or do that, that is against other people. I hope you hear me in that. Simple matters. Don't sit here. Don't. At the end, what do we have now? When you have to worry about children being separated from their parents.
Yeah.
Have you thought that this is where it should come in the United States?
Professor Rosenfeld, did you want to share a thought about that?
What Dr. Ornstein is talking about is really crucial, and that's indifference. Her fellow countryman, Elie Wiesel, said that the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Coldness towards cruelty done towards others, just a lack of caring, it's not my business. And if that, in fact, prevails, then the future is not a good one. It's true. There are things we can do, however, and Dr. Ornstein and others are doing them, and that's open people's eyes to what happens when cruelty sets in and goes unopposed. We're living in a very, very overwrought time now, and it's a time that's seeing many things come to the surface that have long existed on the margins, under the rocks, but they're now heading towards the mainstream. The internet, by the way, plays a big, big role in all of this. The biggest disseminator of hate speech, including anti-Semitic hate speech, is online. And we have to figure out a way to deal with that and with so much else.
Well, Professor Rosenfeld, if I just might ask briefly, what do we do given things like the siloing of information on the internet if, A, people don't even have to open their eyes anymore, or, B, they don't want to?
What we do in the first place is take it in, recognize how serious, how bad it is and can get, and then just not be passive in the face of all of that. Mm-hmm. Make sure in every way possible, personally, communally, at the local, state, and government level, we enact legislation that will help us deal with it all and just teach and model decency.
Yeah.
Anything short of that is not going to work. But we have a lot that we can do, and there are people, in fact, who right now, Dr. Ornstein is one, but there are many others as well, who are alerting people to what lies ahead. In fact, what already has arrived if we remain indifferent.
Right.
That's the last thing we should do.
Well, Dr. Ornstein, we have a very short time left to go, just a couple of seconds. And I want to tell you that I can't thank you enough for coming in today and
it's
sharing
my pleasure.
Your story.
I really... I'm very happy to be doing this.
You know, and the power and the passion and the bravery with which you tell your story, I still feel you holding your mother's hand, you know. I still feel that. And also, well, just one last thing. You weren't liberated when Auschwitz was. You did not receive your liberation until the end of the war.
Indeed. Yeah. No, we were not in Auschwitz because we were shipped out. And the end reached us in the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
And I worked in a factory there. And
yeah. But ultimately, when the war ended, finally.
The Russians.
Well, Dr. Anna Ornstein, she was 17 years old when she was first sent to Auschwitz. Today, more importantly, is her birthday. Happy birthday, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Professor Alvin Rosenfeld, thank you so much as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.